from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, comedians W. Kamau Bell and Hari Kondabolu are known for their incisive takes on race in America. Bell just wrapped up his CNN special, United Shades of America, and Kondabolu recently released a comedy album, Mainstream American Comic. Now the two longtime friends have teamed up on a new politics podcast called Politically Reactive, giving us their take on this unique presidential election. Join us for a conversation with Kamau Bell and Hari Kondabolu next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Berkeley-based W. Kamau Bell has just finished two big projects, a CNN documentary series on race called United Shades of America, and an hour-long stand-up special on Showtime, Semi-Prominent Negro. Bell rose to semi-prominence with his critically acclaimed FX comedy series, Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell, which was produced by Chris Rock. And it was on Totally Biased that Bell worked with Hari Kondabolu, a writer on the show who did an epic routine dissecting all the things wrong with Apu, the character from The Simpsons. Wired has called Kondabolu the best political comedian you don't know yet. No surprise when the two got together again to produce a weekly podcast this summer on politics called Politically Reactive. It made it to the top 15 podcasts in the country in its first 2 weeks. And in this hour forum, we'll get Bell and Kondabolu's thoughts on a range of topics, including the presidential candidates, the KKK, and Bobby Jindal. Welcome to the program, Kamau Bell.
Hi.
And hi, Hari. You're joining us from Vermont Public Radio, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Hey, Kamau.
Hey, Hari. It feels like it's our podcast. Welcome. Thanks for being our guest, Mina. It's good to have you on.
Yeah, let's just switch roles here. I want to give our listeners just a sense of what the podcast sounds like by playing a little bit of an intro to a politically reactive podcast. And if Danny could cue that up.
From First Look Media and Panoply. This is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kondabolu.
The show where two comedians try to make sense of politics in America.
Even though Frank Ocean didn't release his album last week, you can listen to two men who are just as handsome and whose voices are just as beautiful. Two men, would they clone me?
That's the hard-hitting issues we hit.
Hari's the right clip.
Yeah, the right clip. Yeah, you're happy with that, Hari?
So, no, I'm very happy with it.
So how did it's so unfortunate that this is radio and we can't see your faces. But hey, how did you come up with this idea? Kamau, I'll start with you.
You know, I already had two podcasts and I was like, I think I need a third one. you know, really, Lisa Leingang, who I've known for years, who's worked in alt comedy in L.A. and works at First Look Media now. And they were looking for getting into podcasts and they wanted a political podcast. And she said, you were the first name we thought of. And I was like, I don't want another podcast. You know, I really don't need that thing. You know, like two kids. I think you should only have as many podcasts as you have children. And they were really open to like any suggestions or ideas. Like maybe you could have a co-host, or you could have a regular co-host where so other people can come on, like Hari. And I was like, oh wait, if we can do it, I'll do it. If it's just me and him, like we're co-hosts, like I'll absolutely do it, because the idea to work with Hari again was like that. I will be more tired to work with him again.
Because what is it about working with Hari Kondabolu that makes you say this is going to work?
I mean, and he knows, as we've talked before, he's one of my favorite comedians in the history of comedy. Like, you know, like I love hard. So he's absolutely, I think he's brilliant. He inspires me. He makes me want to be funnier and be smarter and work harder. We're really good friends, but like a lot of really good friends at a certain age, you don't talk as often as you should, you know, because I got two kids. And so we live on opposite sides of the country. So it's funny. A lot of podcasting, I think, is an opportunity to hang out with people you don't see enough. So like it was really like, oh, I get to talk to Hari once a week. I'd like to do that. And we'll turn it into a podcast.
So Hari Kondabolu, you're based in Brooklyn right now?
Yes, that's right.
And so did you meet Kamau Bell by working on Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell, or had you met before that?
No, we met before that. I have a feeling he wouldn't have hired me if we weren't friends before.
yeah, it was an inside job.
Yeah. No, we met in 2008. We did an election tour, pre-election tour called Laugh Out the Vote that our mutual friend Nato Green had set up. And I think Nato really felt that if the two of us were sharing space together, we'd become good friends. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, I'd make a lot of trips to San Francisco and we'd hang out constantly. And I told him, like, I was going to write on a show. And he told me, like, I don't have a show. What are you talking about? And I said, well, no, you're definitely getting a show at some point, and I plan to write for it when it happens. And he kept his end of the deal. So, yeah, it's a long friendship. We've been friends a long time. And you know, everything Kamau said, you know, I echo back. I feel very fortunate to find such a great friend and a mentor and somebody who inspires me constantly and includes me. And all the different things that he does, which, you know, that's I'm very grateful for it. So, yeah, this I mean, again, we don't talk enough, you know, come out as a wife and two kids. And, you know, I'm maintaining my Twitter page and my Facebook profile. And that takes up so much time. So it worked out perfectly.
So the guests you've had on the show, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Dream Hampton, David Zirin, how do you choose Amy Goodman.
Yeah.
How do you choose your interview guests, Kamau Bell?
You know, it's really about people that I want to have conversations with, like people who I think have something that I need to know and that I haven't had a conversation with a lot of it. I mean, Dave Zirin, I met him through Hurry, actually, and he's somebody I feel like people don't know enough about and don't hear enough from.
A journalist for The Nation who analyzes sports.
Yes, and he just got back from Rio, so I was like, let's get his take on the Olympics. And so a lot of these people are people who I feel like either I want to actually, like Dream Hampton, I've never had a half-hour-long conversation with Dream Hampton. I know her, but I would like to hear that, and I think other people like to hear it. And so I think that's a lot of it comes from, like Hari, we had Kathleen Hanna on, who Hari is friends with. Like, this is a friend of mine, and I'd like to hear from this friend, and I think other people need to hear it. So it's really about different voices that aren't heard or conversations with people, different conversations with people you've heard from, like Robert Reich.
And how much is scripted, Hari Kondabol, and how much is it just sort of the two of you kind of, you know, working off each other in the moment?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, certainly there's enough script where we can, you know, have an intro and a close and have questions. So, you know, we're not going in with like, so what do you do, Robert Reich? You know, we have to give them, you know, something. But, you know, everything else we're kind of coming up with on the seat of our pants, you know, like, which is great. I mean, I think that energy that of us improvising actually makes the show even more interesting. I mean, some of my favorite parts, aside from the interviews, are just those moments when we think of something funny and we cut out of whatever we're doing into that section called Hold Up, Wait a Minute.
Yeah.
Or when we're where we like give some information or we, you know, just cut away just to have a quick joke and cut back. I mean, that's very unique and that's two friends who are, you know, improvising with each other. And that part, you know, I think also makes it alive.
Well, I want to play another clip just to give our listeners an example of what it sounds like when you have a guest. And this is with, you know, Oakland native Van Jones, your interview with Van Jones that you did a few weeks ago, like about a month ago,
yeah.
I think.
And I feel like the most important thing I can do is to model for African Americans who may not be the most activist, but who've got to go to work tomorrow and deal with this mess at work. They've got to, you know, go to church and, you know, maybe somebody at church is taking a big swig of the Trump Kool-Aid,
mm-hmm.
Or is nervous about Black Lives Matter. I've got a model for them how you can deal with this stuff and not get fired, how you can deal with this stuff and not get blown out of the conference or pushed out the boardroom, because that's our audience. It's a middle-class, middle-aged audience. And so people tune in and say, well, how come Van isn't talking like he talks on KPFA? Or,
yeah.
or you know, because I'm not on KPFA. If you put me on KPFA, I'm going to be, you know.
Yeah.
That's a different thing.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, man.
Hurry.
Hey, guys, I'm still here.
I know. I thought you dropped out, but what do you want?
I was doing my taxes,
okay.
And I went for a run. And
sorry, we had a black guy meeting in the middle of that.
I'm alone in the studio in New York, like, I thought I was the co-host, not the sidekick.
Emmy.
And what happens to get that Emmy nomination?
And that was Hari Kondabolu and Kamau Bell talking with Van Jones. And you were talking with Van Jones specifically about how he deals with being on CNN and with folks like Jeffrey Lord and what mm-hmm. he remembers about his role as a prominent person that people look to, right, to kind of speak
yeah.
about the community.
Yeah, because, I have been on CNN. I have a show on CNN. I don't play that same role that Van plays where they really send him in. You're the voice of the left and we've got the voice of the right and you guys have to duke it out. And I've heard – and also Van's from the Bay Area. So I've heard people go, why is Van not schooling this guy? Why is Van not getting in his face? Van used to blah, blah, blah. And so that was a great example of like, this is a question I hear in the streets. And I want to ask Van in person what that's like. So that he, because I feel like that's also what the podcast is. We're trying to have different conversations. And so, you know, it's a more nuanced conversation than like, why aren't you schooling Jeffrey Lord? But why? And I was like, you're clearly making a choice not to do that. Why are you making that choice?
And we're talking with W. Kamau Bell and Hari Kondabolu. They are comedians and co-hosts of the Politically Reactive podcast. Hari Kondabolu just released a new comedy album called Mainstream American Comic. And Kamau Bell is the host of CNN's United Shades of America and the former host of Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. You mentioned just before I reintroduced you guys to our listeners that you don't have the same role as Van Jones. But do you feel like how do you feel about the role, though, that you seem to be taking on more and more frequently, which is speaking for the black community? It feels like you have, when I hear some of the things that you say and do, yeah, like you have kind of an ambivalent relationship with it a little bit.
I do have an ambivalent relationship with it because I wasn't elected to speak for the black community. I mean, I feel like that I have to, and it's also in this 21st century age, I will say something and then I will open up my phone after the appearance is over and people will let me know that I didn't say it correctly or that that's not what people think. So I'm trying to really in those moments own the things that I think are me and then also make clear the things that I think are generally true. But even in those, it's hard to have that role, especially when you weren't elected to it, you know, or you weren't. It's like, you know, Van Jones has more stock in that role than I do. But I think the problem is, and this is what Chris Rock told me with Totally Biased, the minute you're a prominent or semi-prominent black person on TV, you automatically become one of the spokespeople for the community.
And Hari Kondabolu, I have a similar question for you. I mean, do you feel like you've become a spokesperson for the Indian American community?
I mean, I think some people would say yes and some people would say no. I think it, you know, which means I'm not, you know, I mean, I think I represent myself. I've never said that I represent anybody else. And I think what Kamau says echoes true for me as well. I think people like to claim that and get my perspective and for that reason to fill a certain space. But like, as far as I'm concerned, I'm speaking for myself and my unique set of experiences. And I feel like that's all you can really do.
Yeah. And I think also one of the things that I've noticed in your work, Hari Kondabolu, is that you are also trying to take down some of those images that have been held up as ways of understanding the Indian American community, whether it be with Apu, the Simpsons character, or Bobby Jindal. It feels like you hold a special place for Bobby Jindal. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, like what the effect of folks like that you feel like have on the community, characters
well, I mean,
like Bobby Jindal.
Sure. I mean, first of all, with Apu, I mean, he comes from a time period where he was the only Indian American character on television and he was voiced by a white guy. I mean, that was the reality of it. And I think it's tricky when you have very limited representation, right? Because when you have very limited representation, like on one end, brown people are goofy and silly and couldn't hurt anybody. And on the other end, we're seen as terrorists. I mean, that's a broad range of humanity there and nothing in the middle. Nothing in the middle. It's one or the other. And so I don't think that helps when a terrorist attack happens and you're like, well, either brown people are not scary and won't scare, you know, they're not threatening at all, or they're terrorists. Let's err on the side of terrorists. You know, I mean, that's the scary part. I mean, I think you need a diversity of images so people have the ability to see you as a human being when terrible things go down. In terms of Bobby Jindal, I mean, I think for me it's difficult because I disagree with his point of view of what being an American is fundamentally. As somebody who is also the child of Indian immigrants, who is from Queens, New York, a very diverse setting, and who views Americanness as not something you assimilate to but help create constantly. It's something that is always shifting and mutating. And I see that in Queens. I mean, the future everyone fears in this country is a diverse, multilingual community, which is where I grew up. So I think I fundamentally cannot support somebody who believes in assimilation and is so anti-immigrant in his rhetoric.
And I should remind folks that Bobby Jindal is the former Louisiana governor. How does that inform your politics then, Hari Kondabolu?
How does the fact that he exists?
No. I mean, your view of what it means to be American and that you support integration, not assimilation.
I mean, growing up in Queens, I think for a lot of us, that's a no-brainer. You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't like a choice. I mean, I didn't know that many people who were white. I mean, I did, but everyone I knew was either like, no, I'm Greek. No, I'm Irish. No, I'm Italian, even though they've never been to the nations that they're from, apparently. And it's generations removed, but it's an immigrant-heavy city. And I think that is I always felt like I was part of something. And the only times I felt like that I wasn't part of something is watching television. And I'm like, oh, apparently we don't exist in the outside world outside of this bubble. And then traveling the country and living in other places, I see that too. So, I mean, right there, I see the pressure to assimilate when I'm not in a diverse setting. And I see what it's like to actually be a part of something, and I know that exists. And I feel like for a lot of people of color who live in places where they're the one of something, the pressure to assimilate becomes that much greater. And to me, I know what it's like to be part of a larger whole and love who I am.
Did I read right that you interned for Hillary Clinton at one point?
I was 19 years old, yes. Hey, I was a child and yes, I interned for then-Senator Hillary Clinton, Senator of New York State in Washington, D.C. It was in the summer of 2002.
So wait, how come you're almost sounding apologetic about that?
I mean, first of all, in terms of mainstream electoral politics, to me, it's sports. I follow sports and I follow mainstream electoral politics, but I'm not someone who, values that as much as real grassroots organizing. Like, whenever people would say, like, Bernie Sanders is the voice of the revolution, I'm like, an old white dude is not the voice of the revolution. Calm down. Like, we're talking about something that's a lot greater. We're talking about a bigger movement. So that's what I'm interested in, movements. So that's one part. And secondly, as much as I think Hillary Clinton is a historic candidate, and her being elected would certainly have a great deal of symbolic value, there's a lot of things about her candidacy that I have issues with, and a lot of things that she has done in the past. But to be fair, she's a politician, and so I'm criticizing her for being a politician. So, and that's another reason why I'm more about grassroots organizing and people, fighting from the ground up.
And you were an immigrants' rights organizer before you decided to focus more on comedy.
Yeah. I was in the more lucrative profession of immigrant rights organizing before I switched gears into comedy.
So, W. Kamau Bell, you...
I was about to go, hey, guys, I'm still here.
you really talked about... I'm going to ask you kind of a broad question to start, but just because what do you make of our presidential candidates? I mean...
It's funny. I always think of that Malcolm X quote that got him in trouble. The chickens have come home to roost. That this is, this on the Trump side of things. At the same time in 2012 when Romney lost and the Republican establishment was talking about a big tent, we need to make the tent bigger. At the same time, they allowed Donald Trump to question the authenticity of Barack Obama's birth certificate. And they fed into it. Every time the Republican establishment was asked about it, they said, I mean, I've never seen his birth certificate either. They did that thing where they tried to walk down the middle of the street. it's like, I don't know, could be, I have no idea. And now this is the car hitting them as they were walking down the middle of the street. This is exactly what you get. Donald Trump is the manifestation of allowing the Tea Party to metastasize into what is now the alt-right, I guess.
The alt-right. I have to ask you about your experience meeting with the Ku Klux Klan, because that was something that you did for United Shades of America, which was your CNN series that just wrapped up. And it was your very first show. First of all, why did you want to meet with them?
The whole idea for the show is that, putting myself in uncomfortable positions. And for years I've always paid attention to the Klan's movements in this country as the way the prey should always pay attention to the predator. I've always been a student of is the Klan still around? Oh, they are still around. Oh, they've got a museum. And I've always been curious about engaging with those people. And so when the show was pitched to me, that was my first idea. I was like, I'd like to talk to the Klan. And also being aware that, CNN already has documentary series, so what can we do that the other series can't do? So it was just very clear to me that, like, and also, what can I do? For me, I'm more interested in the experience almost than the TV show. Like, if the show never airs, I get to have this experience. And so with that pilot, that was, I was like, let me go. This is what I'm interested in.
I think we actually have a clip from that show where you do meet with the KKK. You actually sit down with a leader of a branch of it at a diner who isn't, you know, wearing the traditional robes. And you're having a conversation about sort of his views on things.
The Klan, to me, is just a tool to reach people. I feel that it gets the biggest bang for the buck.
Okay.
And that's why I joined the Klan. Bang for the buck.
Okay.
And that's why I joined the Klan. Mm-hmm. But my personal belief, okay, is that black people cannot maintain law and order on their own.
Really?
That's my personal belief.
And why do you think that is?
White people have a have an inner drive for discipline and law and order.
All white people?
No, not all white people.
Okay.
some are really trash.
All right, as long as, okay, all right, all right. As long as we agree with that, yeah.
But I sincerely believe that if people of my character and racial integrity were in charge, your communities would be safe again.
Sounds like a lightweight Donald Trump speech, doesn't it?
Did you think ahead of time about how you were going to respond when they were saying things like this?
I don't think I could prepare for it because I didn't know to what level they would sort of hold the company line and how they would even treat me. And then there was also like people ask me, why didn't you do this or why didn't you that? There was also a sense of like, is there a guy behind me right now about to kill me? You know what I mean? Like there's a sense of like, I don't know what their plan is. And it's like not that – and a lot of these groups said, well, we don't kill anybody. We're not violent. But I was like, I don't know. And so there's also a sense of like being nervous about the experience. So I didn't know how to respond. I was happy in that moment, and I had to argue to get that moment in where he said white people are do better at law and order. And I was like, all white people? Like, you know, and he went, no, some white people are trash. And I mean, like, well, you've just defeated your own argument, you know. So I had to get comfortable, and then I had to sort of use humor to sort of relax me and hopefully relax them and get them to open up.
And when you say people were like, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? Why didn't you do what?
Turn it into a Jerry Springer episode where we start throwing chairs. You know, why don't I confront them more? Why am I not more confrontational? And first of all, it's not really my style. And second of all, because we've already seen that Jerry Springer episode. You know, what is that going to accomplish? My goal was to let them get comfortable and open up so people could see what was out there. And that episode really a Rorschach test. For a lot of black people, there was a sense of like, I already knew the Klan was out there. I don't need to see this. But for most white people I heard from, they're like, I had no idea. And so for me, it's like, that's there. Good. Now you know it's there.
And they do come off as small and yes. Silly in watching it. But were you also worried that they could come off as sort of more normalized? You know, that people could see them and go, oh, I guess they're not as scary as, you know, I thought they were.
No, because as much as they come off as small and silly, they still live in towns. They're still ruining people's small towns, you know what I mean? Like that Harrison, Arkansas. We talked to people in Harrison, Arkansas who were upset about the fact they were there and were upset that the town has been determined to be that.
Yeah. Well, more with comedians Kamau Bell and Hari Kondabolu after the break. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with comedians W. Kamau Bell and Hari Kondabolu, who've teamed up recently for a new podcast called Politically Reactive. Bell is the host of CNN's United Shades of America and the former host of Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. His new comedy special, Semi-Prominent Negro, comes out on CD and a digital download on September 30th. Hari Kondabolu, besides being the co-host of Politically Reactive, has also released a new comedy album called Mainstream American Comic, and he'll be headlining at Cobb's Comedy Club September 22nd through the 24th. And if you'd like to talk to these two, you can give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on Facebook, on our website, kqed.org/forum, and you can tweet us at KQED Forum. And a listener writes, so this is a little bit of pushback for you, Hari. I want to give you a chance to respond. He says, a listener with the Twitter handle Bernie v. Trump 2016 tweets, an old white guy can't lead a revolution? Your guest, what a bigot.
I knew that was coming when he said that. I was like, uh-oh, you're in the Bay Area, Hari. Good luck.
All right, Hari, what's your response?
I feel like the fact he called me a bigot and his complete his inability to understand how power and oppression works based on that statement immediately takes him out of the running for the revolution. I mean, making it and leading it. So that's an absurd thing. I think that when in the history of the world, when oppressed people have to fight back, they can have allies, but those allies cannot lead because generally it doesn't work out in their favor. And so, you know, I stand behind that. And I'm not a bigot. That's a ridiculous thing to say.
Okay.
It's not. Where am I supposed to go with that?
You know? By the way, I'm not sure that listener was a man, but because it was a tweet. Oh. But
I assumed it was a man because it was a crappy thing to say. that's generally where we've mastered that. And to quote W. Kamau Bell, most of my best whites are friends.
Well, I want to play actually just one more example from your podcast, Politically Reactive, because I found it interesting. And this is one where you are responding to some listener criticism about something that you said on a previous podcast.
Hey, Kamau. When Julian Assange and Edward Snowden talk, you think they, talk about how terrible their hellholes are?
Do they ask each other questions like, hey, what do you miss about going outside?
Yeah, so we got a lot of comments from our listeners about some really important details that we forgot to mention, which we are embarrassed about. We joked about Assange ordering takeout while staying in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He's been there since 2012, but we failed to mention that he's there because he's avoiding extradition to Sweden, where he's wanted on rape charges. It was originally molestation and rape charges, but Swedish prosecutors had to drop their investigation into the molestation charge because they ran out of time to legally question Assange. So this is a miss on our part. It was a brain fart. We slipped up.
We were having fun talking about what it's like to order food while you're in asylum, but we obviously left out all the ugly parts. So here's what we're saying. If there's other stuff we've screwed up, let us know.
So I found it interesting. So that's a clip from Politically Reactive where you're responding to some listeners, I guess, who were frustrated that you didn't talk about the totality of Assange's crimes and kind of, were joking about where he was. And what made you want to include that, because I feel like in some ways you guys are comedians. Comedy tends to get a pass for that kind of stuff.
I think comedy used to get a pass for that kind of stuff. I don't think any comedy gets that pass for it if the wrong person sees it anymore or if the right person.
Especially our comedy.
Yeah, especially our comedy because we do try to be – we're promoting an anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-homophobic, anti-misogynist agenda. And the thing is, but we're also just people talking. And sometimes with your friends, you do say things that are – that you have a joke where you laugh at and you go, well, I hope nobody else hears that or, don't quote me on that. But we're making a podcast. So people understand you might have that moment where you say something that's inappropriate. But because we're making this podcast, we have to respond to it when we get legitimate pushback.
Well, Kim asked – Hari Kondabolu, go ahead.
I mean it's humility, accountability, and love. And that's the reason we do that because I feel we love the people that listen and we know that there's a lot of the folks that listen are very sensitive and passionate and fight for justice. And, we love that. We want to support that. And if we feel like we messed up, why wouldn't we? Our ego isn't something that should get in the way.
Well, Kim asks, and I think this is kind of along the lines of what we're talking about. She says, we've seen rape jokes fail, but they can also be funny. Actually, we had Lindy West, the blogger, on a couple of weeks ago. But Kim goes on to ask, what makes a joke about race actually work? Hari Kondabolu, do you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, first, let me address the rape joke part. It's not to say that any topic cannot be funny. That's irrelevant. The thing is, if something's funny and is intrinsically wrong in terms of its ability to hurt people, the fact it's funny and it's effective actually makes it more hurtful because people give it a pass. So I don't see those aren't the same thing, first of all. In terms of discussing race, I feel like, being transgressive in certain ways certainly helps comedy. And by transgressive, I mean like willing to talk about things people don't feel comfortable talking about, that is not in polite conversation, things that speak to a truth that maybe people feel or know but they're unable to share. I think that's the reason why I think race in particular, something that as much as we talk about it in this country, we don't talk about it honestly and from the heart. We talk about it politically and find ways to, you know, and superficially, and we don't get into the depth, the actual heart of the issues. So I think that's the reason why a lot of it works.
Yeah, and I think
the thing that
people sort of forget with comedy, everybody has a different definition of what is funny. So if comedy is one of the only things where people go, if it's not funny to me, then it's not funny. And ultimately, we all have our different sense of what that aesthetic line is. And so as a comedian, you have to know that sometimes a joke that you do is fine for some people, but not fine for other people. And we live in the 21st century where we're all crossing streams all the time. So your joke will get to somebody who really shouldn't see that joke, and then you have to deal with it.
Well, let's go to Paul in Oakland. Hi, Paul.
Hi, W. Kamau, this is Paul. I would go back to Field Negro Guide, and I was the dude hustling you for doing a piece on black surfers. And
oh, yeah, I know you.
Yeah, and then Harry, I actually know, the three of us know a person in education here in the Bay Area, and that's how I came to your work as well. So shout out to both of you for finally getting this going. I wanted to ask, what I find really impressive or impactful here is that it's a black man and an Indian man, and if you could talk, and if you could inject into your work sometimes some work around what that means in this country currently, right? There's a guy, a rapper named Heems, who does a lot of work in this place, the space around the intersection between the struggle for black folks and Indian folks. And then also a guy out of Emory, Gyanendra Patek, who wrote a book called The History of Prejudice. And I'd love to see you guys with a comedic lens kind of start to talk about how we cross over in ways. And I'll leave a comment for you guys. Take care, y'all.
I mean, it's funny. In this interview already, we're just mentioning people that we both know. Heems was the rapper in Das Racist. My brother was in Das Racist. Mm. So, and Lindy West is one of my best friends. So it's been funny because you're just
mentioning. It's a small community.
Totally biased with you. She's the Seattle blogger who confronts misogyny and other feminist issues.
And she's got a book, Shrill, that's out right now.
Yeah, that's actually what we reviewed. Yeah.
I mean, I think that in some ways, I think Kamau and I do that partially by existing and sharing a space and sharing values. And I think that I realize that doesn't confront certain issues. And you're right. I think we should discuss them. The role, and I've thought about this a lot and discussed it a bit, just the role that Asian Americans, South Asian Americans have to play in fighting racism, especially when we're used as model minorities and we're used, you know, Du Bois talked about black people being posed as the problem in America. Vijay Prashad, in his book, The Karma of Brown Folk, talks about how Asians and South Asians are used by America as the solution to the black problem. And so, you know, I think it's our responsibility to confront that and work together to fight racism. And the fact that, for example, Black Lives Matter, I mean, we have to be on the forefront of that with our as allies to our black brothers and sisters, because like we are part of that struggle. We have to, because we're part of the oppression, whether we know it or not. So, you know, I think that's something we'll get to. And certainly I see our friendship not only as something that's incredible for each of us, but something that symbolically I feel like means a lot.
Yeah. You know, Hari, I'd like to actually play a clip from your new album, I think it is. It's Mainstream American Comic. Right. And I'm curious first, what made you come up with that name?
Oh, sure. I hate when people discuss my comedy as activist comedy or social justice or even political. And I understand it for the purpose of branding. But, you know, the issues that we're talking about and the issues that I talk about in the act, like, to me, those are mainstream issues. Those are things that affect people who believe in the idea of activism and people who don't. It still affects them. So these are mainstream issues that we should all discuss. So that's one reason I called it that. And also the idea of niching a person, it's an easy way to dismiss a person, to take them out of the larger conversation. And also, you know, like what we discussed before, I'm an American. I'm part of this country, you know, and why should I be seen as anything other than that? And also, I like the idea of somebody Googling mainstream America or mainstream American comic and my face shows up. So all those things.
Well, this is a clip where you talk about your parents and particularly your mom, I believe.
Sometimes people ask me, how come when you do impressions of your parents, you don't use accents? And the answer to that question is f*** you. That's why I don't use accents. My parents are immigrants with accents. I'm sure they have it hard enough. People questioning their intelligence, making fun of them behind their back. I don't want to make their life any harder, even though, like, they laugh at Chinese accents, so they kind of deserve it. But, like... But I'm not going to do that to them. I love my parents. I don't want to put them through anything else, right? Like, I think about what my mom's been through in this country, right? People saying things like, take that dot off your head. Or, why are you wearing bed sheets out of the house? Or, why don't you shut up and make me food? And this is just stuff me and my brother said to her growing up. Now, can you imagine what she dealt with out of the house? People who didn't love her. For those of you who are groaning right now, my mom approved that joke, so go to hell, all right? My mom specifically told me to tell that joke. She told me to. She said, yes, tell them you're a piece of shit. Tell them that. Tell them. Tell them how disappointed you and your brother are. Please, tell them that. Tell them about the terrible hand I've been dealt. Please, let them know.
It's a good joke. It's good. It's a series of good jokes.
It's a good joke.
And you're showing sort of a side, I think, of you're making fun of yourself as well, which both you and Kamau, I think, do a lot in your comedy. I just wanted to ask you really quick, because I think there's this thing that kids of immigrant parents go through where they suddenly realize that their immigrant parents are actually cool or funny. And I'm wondering if that happened to you, like where you had a moment where you're like, yeah. Oh, my God, my mom is actually amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I think I was in a bit of a rut last year, and I spent a lot of time at home with my folks. And my mom was just constantly cracking me up. And all of a sudden it hit me like, oh, this is where it comes from. All these years people have asked me, like, how am I funny and where did I get it from? It's like, oh, it's her. Of course it's her. You know, she's an incredibly funny, thoughtful human being who used humor as a way to survive in a new country with a lot of tragedy. And that's something, you know, definitely I got from her. And I'm not sure if it's a universal experience, but I can definitely speak to my experience. Like, yeah, absolutely. That's something I caught on way too late.
You know, Kamau, Bell, there was something that I heard you talk about once in an interview where you described yourself as an introvert.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, picture you that way. And when you decided that you were not going to be necessarily so introverted about how you felt, or maybe you still are, but you've
No, I'm absolutely still an introvert. There's no question. I think there's something about being a comedian where it makes introverted people sort of go, I can't not do this. I think it's like not to sort of put it on some sort of biblical calling, but it is a thing where it's like if you could talk yourself out of it, you would. And I'm certainly that person who friends of mine will tell you I've tried to quit many times. Like it's just too much. I hate sort of having to be in that place. And that's why it's like the spokesman role is not a role I ran towards. This is just I think Hari would probably say this too. There's something inside of me that says say these things on stage. Like something inside of me that says, I wonder what people, how will react if I say this. And that's bigger than the need to not be seen by people.
Hmm. And so then how do you fuel up to do it, right? Because how do you...
A lot of Red Bull because I'm a dad. Yeah. Everybody who knows me knows, get Kamau a Red Bull before he goes on stage because he's exhausted. And, you know, trying to make sure I have something to say that is worth saying. I think, like, you know, my process of creative process has evolved a lot through the years from, like, stacks and stacks of notebooks filled with writing to, like, now my phone, it just says, Trump bigot, you know, or something where it's just like, there's something there. And really just trying to make sure that you're on stage saying something that's meaningful to you and that you're going to... being excited about having fun on stage, like, oh, I can't wait to see how people react to this, or I can't wait to do this act out with this bit, like being excited about the act of performance.
So when I watched Semi-Prominent Negro, there was this moment where you talked about how that you're married to a white woman, that your kids are mixed race, and how sometimes you get flack from, you know, some black folks about not like keeping it real. Do you really get that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it sort of came to the head through that I realized how big it was after I had a situation in Berkeley where I was kicked out of a coffee shop for talking to my wife.
This was well known here, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of my main credits. you may recognize this other comic from being kicked out of a coffee shop in Berkeley, the Elmwood Cafe. And So
because the wait person there saw you talking with your wife and at a table with all white women.
Yeah, apparently a customer saw a black guy talking to a table of white women and complained to the staff. And then the staff assumed, yeah, well, how could a black guy talk to white women and that be okay? And so they told me to leave twice. And so, you know, that's well documented. But after there became a situation where it became viral in the Bay Area and I got tagged in a lot of stuff. And one of these things was a Facebook. People tagged me in it, which I think is crazy. In this long Facebook train with a bunch of black people talking about that's what he gets for being married to a white woman. And you're just like, what are you talking about? Like, it's just like, how can you think that makes sense? And then why would you tag me in it? So to me, it's like, this is me. A lot of times interracial relationships and interracial marriages and mixed race kids are the brunt of jokes in stand-up comedy or in comedy. They're sort of the punchline. And a big part of my special, probably half of it, is about claiming space for interracial relationships and mixed race families. Not trumpeting them as being better, but just claiming that space. And so that joke that you talk about is one of my favorite jokes I've ever written because I basically, you know, turn something that people think is a deficit. Oh, he's a black guy married to a white woman and they have mixed race kids, and turned it into and ended up with Malcolm X's By Any Means Necessary. You know, so for me, I'm like, mission. That's one of the times you write a joke like, mission accomplished, you know.
When we're talking with W. Kamau Bell and Hari Kondabolu, co-hosts of the new podcast, Politically Reactive. And if you want to catch Semi-Prominent Negro, Bell's comedy special comes out on CD and digital download on September 30th. And earlier we talked about Mainstream American Comic by Hari Kondabolu, and he'll be headlining at Cobb's Comedy Club September 22nd through the 24th. And his album is out right now. Well, Shannon writes, my boyfriend and I love watching your show, Kamau, United Shades of America. We were compelled by your show on people who live off the grid and the joke about the racial discrepancy of your situation and that of Anthony Bourdain. We were curious about how you've experienced hosting a travel show as a black man and comedian. Do you think the differences in the situations you're put in are different because of race?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's funny when people ask questions like this. I think the difference in the situations I'm put in life are because of race. You know, like I feel like I experience my black manness no matter where I go and in the world. And so hosting a travel show, it just becomes part and parcel of hosting this documentary series. And yeah, so and also, we're pursuing things where that we're being a where me my identity becomes interesting in that situation, becomes either like something that adds to it or might take away from it. And so we're, you know, I love Bourdain. Bourdain's show is great. I kind of wish I had that show where you just got to travel around, eat good food, and hang out on the beach. And he's great at it. Let me be clear. He's one of the he's with his show. Without his show, my show doesn't exist. But my show is about sort of the crossing borders in a way that crossing lines and putting myself in uncomfortable situations. So I think this is the show I'm supposed to have. I don't want a different show.
Well, just as a quick follow-up, Matt writes, does United Shades get a second season? Also, any chance for a cameo in Doc McStuffins?
You'd have to talk to the creator of Doc McStuffins. Talk to Chris Nee on Twitter. She's on Chris Doc Nee on Twitter. But, you know, I feel like I'm happy to represent Doc McStuffins. I don't need to be in the show. Unless they really want me, then I'll do it. But, you know, if I'm a magic eight ball and I'm, you know, about season two of United States of America, signs point to yes. You know, I can't, you know, it's showbiz, so everything's crazy. They could, CNN could start to sell widgets tomorrow and they don't do TV anymore. But, you know, but current signs point to yes. I feel very positive
all
about
right.
it. And I don't generally feel positive about anything.
Well, Hari Kondabolu, a listener, writes, where do you get your news? Any favorite outlets you want to share?
Oh, yeah. I love Yahoo News. I love E! Online. No, I don't know. I mean,
it's like Yahoo. I'm at Yahoo.
I mean, you know, I mean, I watch CNN and MSNBC and even Fox News sometimes for the sake of comparison. The Guardian is pretty consistent. And honestly, a lot of times, you know, I trust the people that I'm friends with on Facebook, and there's a reason I'm friends with a lot of them, and I feel like the stuff they put out there is stuff I'm curious about and I want to read. And so that certainly informs me as well, though I'm not just restricted to that, which I feel unfortunately a lot of us are for the sake of time. So, yeah, it's a kind of a broad range. Certainly public radio, you know, is wonderful. So, yeah, it's all those things.
Yeah, thanks.
I still read the New York Times.
Hey, do you want to add anything, Kamau, or do you have a different – he sort of samples everything, it sounds
yeah,
like.
I mean, I think Twitter for me is like I follow the right people on Twitter. Like, I mean, this is who I define as the right people. But, you know, so it's really like, you know, there's a lot of great writing done from sites that aren't the mainstream sites. Like, so like, I mean, not that the root.com is a great site. The Establishment, which is a local site out of Berkeley, which is mostly staffed by women writers, is a great site. Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, and then, you know, it's funny. Following people who send you the articles from mainstream media is the big thing. Like, if you follow the right people, they will send you articles. It doesn't matter where they come from, but it's like they're curating the news for you.
Yeah, and Hari Kondabolu, you've made some interesting points about Twitter and how it actually sort of decentralizes the emphasis on what white people care about in terms of news and information by kind of giving you a lens into what communities specifically, what are the big issues to them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Summarize
I did make
to the point where you have nothing
sure.
else to add.
No. I mean, yeah. I mean, I do think that there's the idea of Black Twitter, right? Like the idea that this is a force on this site that is shared by everyone, and the fact that like it's not controlled by a singular like entity. It's not. There's no editorializing. It's like, no, these are the people that belong to this community who are talking about the things they care about. And definitely when I was doing the Bobby Jindal is So White hashtag, which took off, I think it was a couple of years ago now, I found out there was a brown Twitter, which I did not know existed really. and I consolidated its power to, you know, make that man's life miserable on the internet. So I feel like, you know, that it's a great way to have our voices be heard, whoever our is, you know, and it's a way to take power back. And as much as I, you know, have a lot of issues with social media dictating what we think and what, you know, what the news is, I also love the fact that the mainstream media has become so dependent on social media that we could actually change the narrative from it. Mm-hmm. And especially from oppressed groups. That's huge.
I feel like I have to name Sean King, Mother Jones, Colorlines.com, and Very Smart Brothers. I'm looking at my Twitter. Like, those are the actual. These are the people I've retweeted recently, so yes.
Well, let's go to more calls, and the number, again, is 866-733-6786. Mick in Marin. Hi, Mick.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
My question is, I was fascinated by the interview with the KKK member, and have either of you or both of you interviewed people who are a little more well-educated, the better educated white nationalists like Peter Brimlow or V. Dare, American Renaissance?
Wow, you know all the names. I have not talked to those people. A lot of those people, you have to know, when we shot the first that episode of United States of America, the show didn't exist and nobody understood what we were doing. So we got the people who would talk to us. And I think that like maybe as we go forward, now that the show exists and has been Emmy nominated, we'll get to the higher people. But a lot of those people don't like the idea of sitting across from a comedian on CNN to talk. So, you know, all we can do is hope that we talk to the people who will talk to us.
And I've never had any kind of – I'm not as brave as Kamau in terms of interacting with white supremacists. I'm fine with, you know, my interactions being them sending me death threats on a variety of social media, and that's enough for me.
Kamau, why do you think they were willing to talk with you? Do you think they felt like, you know, going on CNN would be good for them?
Yes.
Raise their exposure.
I think, you know, and some people said, why are you giving the Klan a platform? I don't believe anybody who wasn't going to join the Klan already saw my show and was like, huh, this show has talked me into joining the Klan. And if you did join the Klan after watching my show, you probably need to watch it again because I don't think we really showed them in a great light. But, or you were going to join anyway, no matter what happened. So, we live in a reality TV era. Everybody wants to be on TV. Everybody wants to keep up with the Kardashians. And I think that even the Klan.
Well, Daniel writes, can you speak to the phenomenon that routinely prevents so many worthy non-whites from having a successful TV show?
I can speak to that very directly. We have to take – the tools of production are in our hands now in a way they weren't before. And so now if you are a person who thinks you should be on TV and you're not getting a spot to be on TV, go make the show yourself. Go make the project yourself. Now it's more expensive. It's more hard work. You have to start small. But Issa Rae is about to have a show on HBO, and for years she may still have it, a YouTube channel called Awkward Black Girl, because nobody would give a black woman, black millennial, a comedy show where it was like a sort of a sitcom-style serialized comedy show. So she made it herself. It became popular in its own right. She built it up, and now she has a show on HBO. Now, that's not an easy path, but I think that you have to be willing to, as always, people of color and oppressed people, we have to work harder to get the same or less. So, you know, I think that the industry, like Samantha Bee having her show right now, is going to kick open the door for other women to have shows where they have political perspective. But before Samantha Bee, I'm sure they're like, nah, that can't ever work. That can't ever work. Meanwhile, she had to come out of The Daily Show and establish brand to get that show.
Yeah, and I want to just echo what Kamau just said. I think that Unfortunately, it's still the case. I think, you know, the media is, you know, still controlled mainly by white people, especially white men. And you know, they're going to hire what they know. They're going to take risks with what they know and think will work. However, we are in a new era where we can prove that, yeah, we have value. We can draw people to what we do. And when people of color get opportunities, it's not charity. I think people always say, you know, this is just a diversity hire. No, it's not diversity. People get shows because they're good and, more importantly, because they make money. If you make money, then you're going to get hired. And I think you can prove your economic value by creating your own things now more than ever before.
Well, since you guys have come together on this project, the podcast Politically Reactive, and we're in a really intense political season, I guess one of the things I want to ask with just the 30 seconds or so we have left is what you're hoping the influence will be of your podcast at this time. And I'll start with you, Hari.
I mean, I don't know about influence. At the bare minimum, you know, somebody said that we're like Democracy Now, except people are smiling at the end of it. And I hope for that. Not to say I don't love Amy Goodman. I'm just saying that we try to provide some way to be educated for people to cope with their lives. And I think that's what we can do. And if that leads to people being more active, fantastic.
Yeah, I think, you know, we had Pastor Michael McBride on after the Philando Castile and Alton Sterling killings. And he's a black pastor in Berkeley, and he's a social justice pastor. And that episode gets passed around to white people, learn to how to talk about race and white privilege. And for me, mission accomplished. It's giving people access to a conversation they couldn't have otherwise.
Well, we've been talking with Kamau Bell and Hari Kondabolu, comedians who've got some things you should check out. Mainstream American Comic by Hari Kondabolu and Kamau's Showtime special, Semi-Prominent Negro. And you can also catch Hari Kondabolu at Cobb's Comedy Club, September 22nd through 24th. Thanks to our listeners for joining us. Have a great weekend. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.